countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Now on RTE Radio 1, time for this week's Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, for Pete's sake, where now for horticulture compost? As we get ready for the Tokyo Olympics, we meet Irish Wagyu beef farmers. Cool as a cucumber, Dara meets growers in North Dublin, and Hannah enjoys a trip down memory lane on a horse and trap.
Text 51551. Email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, I'm here in Cora in West Cork, just outside Skibbereen, and it's a beautiful summer's day. And in the background, you can probably hear a tractor turning hay ready for baling tomorrow in this good weather. But let's go back to March 2015. It was Mother's Day. It was a Sunday morning. And Eileen O'Driscoll, it's a morning which changed your life.
That's right. We'd just come home from Mass and we decided we'd go and check our suckler herd of limousine cows. And we had hoped to go that evening to a dance in Dunmanway. So some cows were after calving and others were due to calve. But when we got there, we decided we'd bring one cow home in case there'd be any calving difficulty. And the next thing I knew, I was on the ground. No recollection of coming for me or coming behind me or anything. I was flat on the ground.
You were in the field among these freshly calved cows and their calves.
Yes. No thought of health and safety at that stage, unfortunately.
And were you on your own, Eileen?
No. I had been there earlier twice on my own that day. But thankfully this time, Pádraig, my husband, was with me. And only that he was there, I would hate to think what would happen.
You were in the field.
Yeah.
What's your last memory, or do you remember what happened?
I remember every bit of it very, very clearly. We were saying we'll bring this cow in now in case anything would happen and she'd need veterinary assistance. And then I landed on the ground. My glasses got broken. So Pádraig was just a bit behind me and he came running up. And then the cows had all gathered round. And they were really angry at this stage. And he, with a stick in one hand, he was fighting off the herd of cows and he had to roll me down under electric fence wire to get me out to safety. And then he had to drag me another 5 metres to get me behind a furze bush away from the cows.
Had you realised as you were knocked to the ground what had happened to you?
I had realised I was in trouble. But my biggest thing was I couldn't turn or look. My glasses were gone and I had no idea what part of the field I was in or where I was. And then, unfortunately, we didn't have our mobile phones, so Pádraig had to go home to call the emergency services, which I'll be indebted to for the rest of my life. And he had me behind the furze bush, and I knew I was alone. I was terrified. I was wondering. I was trying to get up. And then I found a strange sensation in my mouth, and putting up my hand, I discovered it was blood coming from a gash I had received in my forehead, which required 14 stitches later that evening at Cork University Hospital.
And we'll move on to that in a moment. Now, we're sitting here in your beautiful garden beside your B&B, which runs alongside the farm here, Pádraig. So where this accident happened is right behind your head, about 600 metres across the farmyard into the field where the cattle were. So you take me back to that moment, and you're coming behind Eileen, going to help her bring home a cow. And what did you come across?
Well, I was only a few metres away. And when Eileen called to say that she was in trouble, by the few metres, by the time I got to her, there was a whole herd of cows working on her.
She was able to shout.
But she was on the ground. So there was a whole herd of cows. So I just had to fight them off as best I could. But Eileen was stretched on the ground and her face was covered with blood. That's the reality of it. And certainly, but definitely I know for a fact that Eileen had gone through those cows twice earlier that day on her own, and were it not for the fact that I was so close that to the body parts we'd be collecting.
And what did you proceed to do then? What sort of instinct did you have?
Well, the instinct was, first of all, to get the cows back from around Eileen, and then to get her out of there. And the fact that Eileen couldn't get up, and I couldn't physically lift her totally, because I had to fight off the cows with one hand, and all I could do was roll Eileen down the field with the other hand in. And I suppose, looking back on it, any damage the cows didn't do, I did manage to do it, but for the lesser of two evils, really.
Yeah.
And then you see, the anger was up with the cows, and I had to actually drag her then behind the furze bush out of the sight of the angry cows.
Thankfully, he did get home, and he did call the emergency services, and they were wonderful.
And all this time you remain conscious?
Completely conscious. I was totally alert. I was under the bush, and I thought Paddick would never come back. You know, and I was trying to get up. I kept trying to get up. If that happened to Paddick, I would not be able to lift him or drag him or pull him. I'd have to lie down beside him and die with him.
Paddick raced back to the house to raise the alarm. Soon paramedics arrived from Skibbereen, but Eileen's injuries were so severe it was decided to airlift her to Cork University Hospital, where she underwent surgery, followed by months of rehabilitation.
I had multiple fractures and gash in my forehead, and it's one thing I hate talking about, my injuries. But the worst part for me after coming back from hospital was not being able to walk on my own. And especially at night, I needed two people. I needed two people to put me in and out of bed. Mm. And nights were the worst, because I would desperately need to get out, and I hated calling my family. And then they would come running. And that really was so emotional.
You felt as if you were losing your dignity.
Absolutely.
Your independence.
And I was a person used to climbing gates rather than going over them. I was fit and active. And all of a sudden, I was lying flat and couldn't do anything for myself. And while they came, they had to put on this guard on me. I mean, I couldn't walk, you know, without this bodyguard. And it was so painful getting me out of bed, trying to put it on, going so slowly. It was all so much against what I was used to doing. And it was very, very hard.
It was better than what could have happened to you. You once they assessed you and realised that you had fractures, the helicopter was sent for. What were your injuries, Eileen?
I
know you don't like talking about them, but what
happened? I had multiple fractures.
To your back?
Yes.
And ribs?
Yeah, my ribs, yeah. I think the fact that so many guests had booked into the bed and breakfast, and then they all were ringing up to know, you know, what's happening and that, and they would say to me like, oh, we'll be no trouble. You know us, we were with you before. And I'd have to explain, I can't open my front door, I can't walk on my own. And then I would wonder, when, if ever, will I walk again? And that was very hard for somebody that was so fit and active. It was just awful. But then my sister was a nurse, and I had to do a lot of physiotherapy. And she was wonderful, because I would have taken a lot of shortcuts. And there was no shortcuts for her.
Yeah.
So it really paid in the end.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be forever grateful, you know, for the help. And what was so important as well was the wonderful neighbours and the kindness I received from so many people. And 'twas like the offers of help and the kindness and the good wishes and the cards that really, really helped me. And the importance of reaching out now to people who are in trouble is very much on my mind. Thankfully,
yeah,
the magical day arrived when I was able to walk again, and I will treasure that memory for the rest of my life.
And Eileen, as somebody that, you know, has been on a farm all your life and in and out with cattle, has it changed your attitude? Are you able to go into a field of cattle now?
Unfortunately, that's the one regret I have. I no longer can go in to a field of cattle, because there is no way ever in my life I would risk that happening again, even if there were as quiet as mice. Never.
You didn't see it happening, Paddick, but obviously what happened was it was the cow, no bull involved here, which traditionally are what are involved in accidents involving farm animals. This was a mother protecting her calf that obviously knocked Eileen over.
That's right, yeah. And of course, I suppose to a certain extent, it was, you could looking back at it, you could say it was fun to some of these cows. It certainly wasn't fun to the us humans. But once one got started, the whole herd moved in on it. Then you see, but we, in reality, if we study into it, all they were doing was protecting their babies. And I think that is something that we, the message we must always try to get across in farming. Watch the freshly calved cow, because believe you me, she is lethal.
I mean, I thought anybody got injured with a cow before or a bull were stupid people. Then I realised, here I am, thinking it could never happen to me. And all of a sudden I'm on the ground.
And is life good now?
Life is brilliant now. Thank you very much, Damien. It's brilliant. And I appreciate every single day being able to get out of bed on my own, dress on my own, use the bathroom on my own, go walking on my own, do my work on my own. It's a miracle. I'm living a miracle now every day of my life, thankfully.
And Padraig, when you go into a field of cattle now, do you always get the flashback?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, you still have to. These are memories that will never leave you. Believe you me, anybody listening to this podcast, these are memories that will never leave.
We're going to leave it there, and thank you both very much for chatting to me. And as I said, I'm glad to see you looking so good again, Eileen. And Padraig, thanks very much, and enjoy the rest of the good weather.
If it saves a life or prevents an accident, it's well worthwhile.
Wise words there from Padraig O'Driscoll and his wife Eileen. They have a lovely B&B down there at Coolbawn Lodge, and they still are involved in farming in Skibbereen. And they were chatting to me as Farm Safety Week begins on Monday. And the message this year is to rethink safety. Agriculture, as we know, remains the most dangerous workplace. And as we speak, we are aware that there are families all over the country that are grieving the loss of loved ones in accidents this summer. This is the 9th year of this multi-agency campaign in Ireland and across the UK. And for more details, do just take a couple of minutes to go to ifa.ie/FSW for Farm Safety Week. That's the letters FSW21. Now, let's change tack, but we're going to stay in Cork, and this time we're off to Mill Street, where busy farmer Conor Sheehan is on the line. Conor, good morning.
Good morning from Mill Street. How's it going?
Very good. Now, there's a week to go till the Tokyo Olympics begin, and I know there's a good few Cork people that are going to be involved, Phil Healy and the rowers and many more as well. But I want to talk to you, Conor, this morning, among other things, about Wagyu beef, which is synonymous with Japan. Firstly, what is Wagyu beef, and how did you get into it?
Wagyu beef is a delicacy in Japan, and about 10 years ago, I wanted to get something different and introduce it into Ireland. So I just Googled it, and I found something that was supposed to be fantastic in Japan, and I goes, you know what? If it's going to be fantastic in Japan, it's going to be fantastic in Mill Street.
Right, and how do they differ from other beef cattle?
They actually take a lot longer to mature. It's probably about 27 months because the genetic gene cuts in at around 27 months. Now, I have the pleasure here of having ground, and I don't really mind having them hanging around for so long.
Yeah.
But I'd be hoping to have a much better product at the end of the day.
So they take longer to finish, as they say?
They would, yeah.
And what do you feed them, grass and other bits and bobs?
Well, I feed them grass-based here now in Ireland, because that's what I have myself, where the Japanese would probably confine them and have a completely different diet. But it's actually the animal itself that brings the texture, the taste and the tenderness. And just it's a very light, it's a delicacy, basically. Yeah. That's what it is.
So it's very expensive as well, isn't it?
Well, it's very, very expensive in Japan, but it's not very expensive in Ireland, because it takes the same length of time, the same amount of feed and time and dedication and the genetics to get it to where we have to try and get it here in Ireland.
Yeah. Will you stay with me there, Conor? You're not the only... So, by the way, how do you pronounce it?
What, Wagyu?
Oh, Wagyu, yeah. I thought you had some Cork way of pronouncing it there earlier.
Wagyu, bye.
So you're not the only Wagyu producer, because we're going to go now to Ridgeway Farm in County Wicklow and big good morning to John Harrigan. John, good morning.
Good morning, Damien. How are you doing?
Very good. How and when did you get into the Wagyu beef?
We're at Wagyu about 8 years now. But the reason I got into it was I was in New York, and we got to eat it in Smith and Walensky, and we thought it was different. We thought it was totally different. So we said it'd be nice to produce something similar to it, or as good as, if we could, you know.
Yeah,
so,
I didn't think poor farmers could be affording to eat Wagyu beef in Smith and Walensky in New York, but anyway.
Sure, when you're out, you know.
You are, yeah. So you came back, but how did you rare them? Did you have to buy embryos, or was there stock here already?
No, we brought in embryos ourselves, and we brought in semen from different parts of the world. So we do an F1, we breed an F1, and we breed full blood Wagyu as well. So yeah. We start off with embryos.
And
initially, yeah.
What did they look like, John? Like, your dad, I know, farms with you. What did he think of them?
He probably thinks they're poor-looking cattle, like, you know, because we'd be used to good continental-type, beefy-type cattle. Like, they're kind of, so like a poor-looking Angus, basically. So
right.
It wouldn't be very aesthetically pleasing if you're used to a big, you know, shapy Belgian Blue or a Charley or a Limousine. But you kind of look out over them when you're herding. We look over the mountains, you know, as well.
Yeah.
So we look out the back.
And Connor, how would you describe one now to a stranger?
I tried to explain to my father what was going to happen in the farm 10 years ago. And when the first calf was born here, he goes, "What in the name of God would you want bringing that thing into this farm?" He was puny and scrawny, he had big shoulders, he had a narrow backside. There was three vets from Milster came up to see the delivery. So as the years went by, fellas had passed and they goes, "Geez, they're awful skinny." But it's the meat and the texture, and that's why it takes the 27 months to get to where we are today. And with John's breeding and his genetics that he's bringing in, we're going to be reducing the feeding from 27 months down to 24, just to make it a little bit more easier on ourselves and loosen up a bit of cash flow. We're getting there. We're nearly as good as the Japanese, if not better. We have the grass-fed, where they don't have grass-fed.
No, they have
their animals confined all the time.
Yeah, and they massage them to keep the blood flowing and all of that. But the great thing about Ireland, as you said, is that you can keep them out. And, John, what do you finish them with? Like, ordinary cattle you'd finish with meal and nuts, but what do you do to give that extra bit of texture to the Wagyu?
We feed them olives and chocolates.
Very nice.
So they get olives and chocolates for the last probably 8 months of their life. So also with meal as well and fibre diet mixed in as well. But yeah. The olives and chocolates, we find is a great help.
And John, do you make money out of them? Do you get the same premium or the same sort of price at the end of the day?
Sure, it's hard to say if you make money out of them, but we like doing it. But
yeah. It's different.
In going forward, hopefully, if we could get a few more of them and make it viable, hopefully it'd be great going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough business. It's long term. You see, Connor said it could be 27 months, it could be 30 months, it could be over 30 months at times.
Yeah.
So they're a late maturing animal, basically.
Yeah, you have to be patient. Now, Connor, you're making a name for yourself this week because you were in control, if I can call it that, of the Irish Farmers Twitter account. And I would ask anybody who has a Twitter account to just go online and go to Irish Farmers, because you've been taking us on a whistle-stop tour of your day-to-day work on the farm there with the family in Mill Street. Are you enjoying it?
Well, I got a phone call there last year from Jack McCarthy in Kentucky. He says, "Connor, you should join this thing." And I didn't realise it was going to take off the way it was, because these things are just everyday things that I do.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise the sheep were going to be the star of the show, but that's the way it goes.
It's Ireland's Farmers, by the way. If anybody listening wants to have a look at it, you don't have to be a farmer, but it's Ireland's Farmers. Isn't that right, Connor?
That's right, yeah.
At Ireland's Farmers. And you're a sheep farmer, you're a cattle farmer, you've been spreading slurry this week, you had a sick calf you brought to the vet. You know, you should have your own TV show, believe me. And it's kind of a, you know, warts and all raw look at life on the farm. It looks really idyllic down there. But farming's coming in for a lot of criticism, Connor, isn't it?
Well, if you look at the Farmers Journal going back 20 years, we've always been criticised for something. There's always negative stories going on about the whole thing. I'd like to throw in a bit of a positive outlook on the whole thing, because there's very few fellas farming anymore.
Yeah.
We were dairy farming here, and it was very hard. Every fellas rushing, the machinery is getting bigger, people have no time to
You're moving around. You're obviously double. You're working away there at the moment because you're coming in and out. But you're telling me you were dairy farming, you get out of it. But and it is a tough business, and farmers do get criticised. But you're actually highlighting, you know, a lot of the nature on your farm in your pieces this week on Twitter.
Yeah, we'd be very lucky. We'd have a lot of biodiversity on the farm. We'd have lakes, and there's a waterfall and nearby, just right behind our house, waterfall. It's kind of full of wildlife, but it's just the nature of the part of the country that we're in. We have a few rolling fields and stuff like that. There's rushes and all this kind of stuff. If you were trying to maintain all the fields to the standard that the EC would want to, I'd never get off the tractor. I'd be spraying every day. I'd get nothing else done.
Yeah.
Well, I'd be efficient in work and I wouldn't be efficient in life.
Yeah, well, look, you're a busy man, as I've been spotting this week and people following you as well, at Ireland's Farmers to see what Conor's doing down there in Mill Street. And listen, enjoy the rest of the weekend. Thanks so much. We might chat to you again, Conor. And John Harrigan there at Widgeway Farm, thank you. And if anybody wants to find out more about Wagyu, they can go to wagyu.ie, and the best of luck to everybody in Tokyo next week.
RTE Radio 1. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Now, just imagine this. Three lads with nice pensionable jobs, one in the army, another in an accountancy firm and another in a semi-state company. And tell them then to just jack in their jobs, rent a glass house, and they have zero experience at doing what they're going to be doing, to go off and grow a crop that some of them haven't even tasted before. It really does sound like a recipe for a disaster, but it happened because a year on, cousins Sean and Gary Weldon, along with Shane Halpin, are running a 3-acre cucumber operation in Rush, North County Dublin. And Darren McCullough went along to meet the lads to hear their story and find out how they're getting on.
So we're standing here beside a plant. I can hear, is that the irrigation dripping off them, is it?
No, that's a leaky pipe there.
A leaky pipe.
Oh,
jeepers. There's always a leak, isn't there? So the pipes, is the food coming into the plant through the pipes, through the water, is it?
Yeah, each plant has a dripper into the pot, and then that's given a solution of feed and water throughout the day. It's constantly monitored to adjust the feed that the plant needs.
This week there was a protest by the IFA about compost and that the horticulture industry was going to go bust if it couldn't get access to compost. I'm not seeing much in the way of compost here.
No, we actually grow in rock wool, which is a different growing medium. It basically is spun out limestone. So as you can see yourself, it's got a nice structure for the roots to grow through, and it holds a lot of water. It's like a big sponge, basically. You see it there.
Yeah.
And you see the roots, how well
it's
they grow
like
through it.
What would be in the insulation, maybe in the attic in a house, is it?
Pretty much, just without the glass.
Okay. Is there potentially a sustainability issue with this system as well? Obviously, you don't need to use peat, which is a good thing, but rock wool, if you have to dump it every year, presumably it's not recyclable, is it?
Well, it's only rock and it's limestone based, so we need to look into how we're disposing of it.
That's the problem for next year, is it? Yeah, jeez, sorry, give me a break. I'm just trying to get going here. Okay, let's talk about the cucumbers. So I'm just here standing beside a plant. They're literally hanking with cucumbers. There's one now that's probably, I'm going to say, a foot long, maybe. Is that ready for picking?
Yeah, we want anything above 300 grams, basically, is what we're going for.
So you're going by eye, is it?
Pretty much, yeah.
How long will a plant keep on throwing cucumbers for? I see on the same plant, there's little ones that are no bigger than my index finger.
Like, as soon as we take this large one off, the next ones will just grow, because the plant will just put it into the next one. So, like, we'll come in here tomorrow and, like, these ones will be swelled up. You nearly pick them tomorrow. It's so quick at growing, and once you have the big one off it, it goes to the next one. So it's constantly producing.
How much or how many cucumbers or how many pounds of cucumbers do you expect to get from a plant?
I think we've been getting roughly 30 to 60 or 30 to 50, something like that per plant. Now that obviously changes.
30 to 60 cucumbers?
Cucumbers, yeah. It, like, if you get the right conditions, the plant will just keep growing. The only reason they stop growing is because we pull them out. you know.
And why would you pull them out?
They get to a point where if you will actually get more cucumbers by over a period of time by starting a new crop. Because inevitably, if you keep taking cucumbers off this plant, it is going to slow down. It will keep producing cucumbers, but not as quick as, say, a new crop.
Yeah.
So that's why we put in new crops. We do five crops a year.
I've been to Tomato Glasshouse before, and the lads are pumping CO2 into the glass because that drives on the plants even further, controlling the insects. Is it the same level of control here? Yeah. No, it's your boiler's your problem, Gary.
Yeah,
yeah.
The problem is right. Yeah.
Jesus, it's like my mistress. But it's a fairly efficient system in the sense that we do burn gas. That will obviously produce CO2, but we will put that back into the glasshouse. The plant needs about 500 ppm parts per million, and we try to keep it at that in the glasshouse.
What would it be normally, like outside the glass?
About 400, 350, 400. The lads who used to own the place kind of had over the 40 years, they've noticed that go up just naturally itself, which is just an interesting point there. But we try to keep
it. Climate change for you, right there, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. There's the man now.
Oh, there's the man himself. Come on in. You're very welcome to your own glass house. Who have we got here?
Tom Collins.
Hiya, Tom. Come on over here.
King of the cucumbers.
you're the man that handed over the reins.
Yeah. We retired in 2019. That was our last growing season. Yeah. And then the guys showed interest in possibly wanting to lease it. And we spent it the next 8 or 10 months negotiating. And here they are, new blood into the industry.
Yeah.
This glass house we're standing in went up in 1972.
There you go, 50 years ago.
50 years ago.
Mother of God, doesn't bear contemplating, does it? And you were a young buck at the time?
My father died suddenly, and I was only just turning 17 at the time. And then a couple of years later, invested here.
For the likes of Shane or Gary or Sean standing here when they're your age, what will they be standing in? What will they be growing? What will the market be like? I know it's kind of hard to crystal ball gaze, but what kind of trends are you seeing?
Well, the trends is into very high-tech greenhouses, which are being built at a huge rate all over the world. But cost is the main thing, and getting the money to do it.
What kind of money are you talking about?
You're looking at probably around €1 million an acre.
€1 million an acre?
Yeah.
For modern glass?
Yeah. That's with everything included.
Wow. High stakes stuff, isn't it?
High stakes, but to future-proof your business, going forward, that's the sort of thing that needs to be done.
Now, this is the pack house where all the magic happens, right? Actually, there's a question. Every cucumber you buy in a shop is shrink-wrapped. What's the point of that?
Well, it actually increases the shelf life of the cucumber exponentially. You know, if you didn't wrap it, it might last a week before you start seeing deterioration of the cucumber. But when you wrap it, it can last up to three, four weeks.
When you say deteriorating, what do you mean? Like
the cucumber will dry out. It'll start getting smaller, lose weight. The taste changes as well. You know, you just lose that freshness.
Okay, so the plastic is actually extending the shelf life.
100%.
And
yeah,
reducing
yeah.
the food waste. Okay, absolutely. All right, so there's a reason for everything.
Of course.
Okay. Can we? You're telling me that these cucumbers are a lot tastier. I'm holding the microphone here. Can somebody do the honours for me and cut a slice? I presume these are just ready to eat. Lovely hurling. Mm-hmm. Yep. Crunchy. Fresh. Cucumbery. Am I saying all the right things?
Yeah.
But there is a difference, isn't there? Like a fresh cucumber. If I just had a little bit of gin and tonic now, it'd be really ideal, right?
It's the other glass house for
it. I presume you all love your cucumbers, right?
Yeah, I love them.
Yeah. What about you now? You're saying suspiciously quiet on this one.
I'd be a little bit of a picky eater, so I'd never really eaten one until, I'd say, about this time last year, maybe, when we started looking.
You hadn't eaten one until this time last year?
This was when we started looking into this, I said, God, I better taste these cucumbers. So I had a cucumber sandwich then when I was away, and they're lovely now. Our stuff doesn't compare, like, it's miles ahead.
Yeah, but, he sent us a picture.
I sent the lads the picture.
Try one of these.
He is blushing furiously now, seriously, you hadn't eaten a cucumber
until
this time last year.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
So you've reconciled yourself with cucumbers anyway, yeah?
I have, yeah. I've been inundated with them now recently, so I'm making up for lost time, definitely, over the last couple of years.
Yeah, that's Gary and Sean Weldon and Shane Helpin there talking to Dara McCullough earlier this week. The best of luck in the future, lads. Well, earlier this week, horticulture farmers, as Dara mentioned there, they gathered outside the Dáil sitting at the convention centre claiming that their sector faces wipeout as peat moss supplies will run out within weeks. 6,000 people are employed full-time in the sector, which includes mushroom growing. Now, Bordnamona has ceased extracting peat for horticultural use, and into the future it will become more difficult to source. The producers met with the Minister with Responsibility in that area, Pippa Hackett, who told them that while peat extraction must stop, she'll look at small-scale extraction for the domestic commercial horticulture sector only while they are transitioning, provided such extraction is legally compliant. Now, Dermot Callaghan is Head of Horticulture with Chagas. Good morning, Dermot.
Good morning, Damien.
Peat, it's an extraordinary substance from the point of view of a horticulturist. What makes it so special and in such demand for them?
I suppose peat is that universal ingredient that has been used, for all plant species in almost all horticultural production systems. So it's one of those products that has some attributes that lends itself to the production of plants. It's a very consistent product. It has a mix. It can be milled after harvesting, so you can generate different particle sizes. So if you look at peat as a raw material, which is developed into a portfolio of different products for different uses in different subsectors of horticulture, it has that nice balance between, air-filled porosity or air space and the combination of high water holding capacity as well. So it gives good drainage characteristics in growing media and is widely suitable. I suppose another important attribute is that it's comparatively lightweight, allowing it and the products grown in it to be easily transported. And it interacts well with existing nursery and farm machinery. One of the key issues with peat is the fact as well that it's stable. So it's well degraded. It doesn't slump in the production process. And it is low in nutrient content as well and low in pH, which this allows kind of accurate levels of nutrients to be added on a consistent basis between batches. So it gives you this batch-to-batch consistency in terms of a raw material.
Yeah.
And then that lends itself in terms of predictability in the production system and trying to hit schedules in terms of output and so on.
Okay, so we can see there how valuable it is to growers, but it will be no more within months and indeed certainly in years. But could we go back to other ways of growing crops with soil? What do we do before we harvested peat?
Well, before, in terms of protected production, soil would have been used and sterilised soil. But you're going back to the 50s and 60s, peat has been around for decades. So all of the commercial reality for growers in the last decades is that they've been using peat. So stepping back into other soil, into the soil, would be a retrograde step. But what growers are, what's being looked at currently is obviously to try and develop alternatives to peat and to look at a long list of potential ingredients or constituents
and
that
how
could
we
be used in peat.
And how are we getting on with looking at alternatives in the meantime?
Well, I suppose there has been an acceleration in terms of research and development into this sector, into the alternatives to peat's area. But the issue has been, I suppose, that there has been a scramble in the last year or two due to the cessation of Bordnamona in terms of extraction. But there has been a scramble for peat supply. And obviously then there's an acceleration now of research and development in this area. Chagas are funding a project to look for peat alternatives currently in the mushroom sector. We've also led an application to the Department of Agriculture with a consortium for a large project in the area covering all the different sectors of horticulture in terms of alternatives. But the challenges could be summarised as finding available and affordable and sustainable alternatives that meet the yield and quality characteristics required by growers. So growers, if you can imagine, you know, you've been using a particular raw material for a very long time. You have to test alternatives. And at the moment, a lot of alternatives that are coming through are blended up to about 50%. But the idea of removing peat completely from a growing media is a big challenge and will require years of research.
Okay.
You see, growers need a degree of predictability. So batch-to-batch consistency of peat growing media means that they can deliver a product, they can get a yield that's required, they can deliver a product on time, and they can make a profit and make a living from it. But if they get 10 or 20% of a reduction in yield, for argument's sake, using alternatives, they're out of business.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very, it has to be really researched here before alternatives are put in play, particularly for the professional sector.
Yeah, an ordinary hobby gardener, if they lose 10 or 20% of their crop using an alternative, it's not the complete end of the world, but it is if you're a big business person. Finally, and briefly, the growers say that only 0.1% of peat from the total peatland area is all they need. But the alternative is to import from the Baltics. Is that feasible or viable, briefly, Dermot?
Well, what I'd say is it's important. Peat is going to be required in terms of blending for the next number of years, probably 10 years or more. Mm-hmm. So they're going to need peat. If they can't get Irish peat, they're going to have to import peat. Peat will have to be part of the solution in the transition period to alternatives. It's really difficult to try and see any other way out. So unfortunately, peat from other areas is not the same as Irish peat, and there's a disruptive impact in terms of the quality of those peats coming in and so on.
Yeah.
We're at the end of a supply chain and we, you know, it's going to cause problems in the production system potentially.
Okay, well, as we saw, Minister Hackett engaged with those farmers the other day, so we'll watch very closely what sort of compromise can be brought into place there in the immediate term. We do know the long-term viability of it is not going to happen anyway. So, interesting times. Dermot, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. That was Dermot Callan, Head of Horticulture with Chagask. Finally this morning, one of the great pleasures of the past year has been dropping into the farm of Catherine Quinn, who farms in County Limerick, along with her granddaughter, Hannah Quinn Mulligan, a reporter with us. Now, they have reminded us of the seasons of the years they've gone along and how we're connected to the past. And this morning, they take us on a jaunt in their pony and trap and have a gentle chat over the clippity-clopping of Kitty's hooves.
It's a happy snort, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, she's delighted.
Who's a pretty pony? Granny, you have her looking like $1 million.
Very happy Kitty.
It looks like we're going to some horse and carriage competition, not for a spin out on the road in the pony and trap. Very happy snorting.
It takes me back to going to mass on a Sunday and whole trap full of us. There wouldn't be enough room hardly for everybody.
And because it was the only way of getting around, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the only way, yes. My mother was excellent at driving the pony in frosty weather, and she prided herself on the fact, you know, that the pony wouldn't slip or fall, you know, a slip or fall.
Did you get taken to school in the pony and trap as well?
We did, yes, if we were lucky, but there wasn't always enough time. So
steady,
sometimes
girl,
my father would take us in the milk cart.
What was the milk cart?
The milk cart was when he was taking the milk to the creamery. But the creamery that we went to was in the opposite direction to the school. So to go to the school, he'd have to go in the opposite direction to where he needed to go. So it doubled his journey. So instead of about 3 miles, he would have had 6 miles to do.
So it was a luxury if you got taken in the pony.
Yes, we wouldn't always get taken in the pony.
I mean, you were the oldest in the family, so I imagine you were the first one to drive the pony and trap.
I actually drove the pony and trap to the town, which was 3 miles away, when I was about 5 years of age.
You did not?
I did.
Yes. So you'd get arrested for that now?
You probably would, but I did. My mother was, she needed shopping desperately, and I don't know where my father was, because normally he would bring the shopping when he went to the creamery. And she was desperate. And the only reason I remember this incident is because I remember her telling someone that called into the house in the evening that she was worried about it, but she had no option. And she tackled up the pony and sent me off to the shops.
And because she had, what, probably you were five, but she had about 3 children under that age,
yes,
to look after,
yes,
as well.
Yes, yeah.
That was one good pony.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the beginning of it, do you know?
Did you ever have to take the milk churns to the creamery?
Oh, I did on a few occasions when my father had to go to a fair or something like that. And I remember I'd have to take the milk to the creamery before going to school. And girls didn't go to the creamery. And so I remember being terrified that I'd meet some of my school friends on their way to school on their bicycles and me coming home from the creamery with my milk carts. I would be terrified that I would meet them, and I can't remember whether I ever met anybody or not, but I remember being worried about it.
And why was it? It's just women didn't go to the creamery? Was it the men's job?
They didn't. Yeah, it was the men's job. Yeah, women didn't ever. You wouldn't see a woman. All the ponies and cars would line up, and there was a platform, and your milk churns were taken off the cart. There were people there to help, so say, because I was a child, really, basically, the men would just take the milk churn, empty it, and put it back on the cart, and you drive around. Yes, it was a really funny thing, because there were people, and that would always be first at the creamery in the morning. And it was a matter of principle, if you like, to be first or second, you know. And, oh, it was a big thing for the people that were into that, because we were never into that. But those are the...
There's a Chiff Chaff singing. Oh, our first car of the day. We've been very lucky. Good girl, steady. People are so good about passing, aren't they? They really slow down.
Yes, most people. And people love seeing the pony and trap.
Oh, we get big waves.
Yes, yeah.
When you were older, did you get to go gallivanting in the pony and trap? Was it like having your first car?
It was, I suppose, yes. On a Sunday, I would take the younger members of the family on a little trip. We'd go and we'd go on a little adventure and take a little picnic and buy ice cream, have a treat. A lovely day for a drive. Just perfect.
Drop down, Kitty. Come on.
Yeah, that was Hannah Quinn Mulligan and Grandmother Catherine enjoying a jaunt on their pony and trap in Limerick. Well, that's about all we have time for this week. I am actually off to Tokyo as part of the RT team that will be bringing you coverage of the 32nd Olympiad, which begins next Friday. It means Marty will be here for the next few weeks. And until I talk to you again in a few weeks' time, thanks to all the team. Bye-bye and thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.